From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. There's such a stigma on aging in our society, especially for women. The common stereotypes are that they're frail, past their prime, and unhappy. Not so. Women have the power to choose the life they want to live in their golden years, says our next guest. She's a 71-year-old cultural psychologist with a rallying cry. This hour on Point, older women, hear me roar. Join us. How are you making the most of growing old? What are the challenges, the joys? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. With me from Boulder, Colorado is Mary Pfeiffer, a cultural psychologist and author of several New York Times bestsellers, including the very popular Reviving Ophelia, Saving the Selves of Adolescent Girls, and The Shelter of Each Other, Rebuilding Our Families. Her new book is Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Mary Pfeiffer, welcome to On Point. How nice to have you.
Thank you, Jane. I'm happy to be here.
Well, so you're 71. You told your friends you were writing a book about older women, and they immediately said to you, hey, we're not old. Stop.
That's
slow
right.
down
That's
here.
That's right. Either we're not old or you're not old, meaning let's none of us say we're old.
Right. So, but talk about some of the cultural stereotypes of women who reach a, quote, certain age.
Well, I think when women distance themselves from saying they're old, what they're really saying is their felt experience doesn't match the cultural scripts for older women. And those cultural scripts are primarily negative. For example, think about mother-in-law jokes. Mm-hmm. I remember when Garrison Keillor was on the air, he had conversations with his mother, and his mother sounded like such a disagreeable, whiny, dependent person. There's a lot of thinking that older women are unattractive, sexless, useless, and in the way. But my own experience, and one of the reasons I wrote this book, is that exactly the opposite is true, that most older women are deeply engaged with the world around them. They're connected to a great many people. They're caring for people. And also that they're in the happiest life stage that they've experienced. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's not just a observed piece of information. We have really good statistical data from Dilip Jest out of UC San Diego mm-hmm. that the happiest demographic in America is women over 65.
Right. And they report higher levels of overall satisfaction and well-being, lower levels of anxiety and depression and stress as they get older. And
that's right.
And
that's
older
right.
women are, I mean, I guess they're happier than we think and they give them credit for.
Right. Well, and what I try to say in this book is that this life stage is a critical life stage, just like teenage girls when I wrote Reviving Ophelia. It's kind of a bookend to that book. Mm-hmm. And the core concern of this stage, with all of its perils and pleasures, is how to cultivate resilient responses to the challenges we face. And I argue that resilience is built by attention and intention. And that while attitude is not everything, it's almost everything in terms of being able to cope well with this life stage.
In fact, you write, to be happy at this junction, we cannot just settle for being a diminished version of our younger selves. We must change the ways we think and behave. So what's the biggest issue a woman faces, do you think, as she transitions from middle age to older age?
Well, let's talk for just a minute about the challenges. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges is ageism, which may actually be a bigger problem for women than aging. Another challenge is oftentimes we lose some of our health. Some aspect of our health suffers, whether we lose eyesight, we develop arthritis, we no longer can jog or carry a backpack up a mountain or play tennis. We have some dysfunction in terms of health that we have to adjust and adapt to. Another thing that happens is we start to experience loss and the grief of losing siblings, friends, partners, life partners. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of challenges. But what I argue is that we also have seven decades of cultivating resources to help us deal with those challenges. So that even though it's a very it's a time of emergencies, but we're at a point in our lives where we're capable of emergent behavior. And in fact, if we don't grow, we become a diminished version of our former selves. But fortunately, this life stage is catalytic for growth because of that oscillation between the despair and grief and loss we experience and the many joys that we have as we move into a time where we're likely not working full time, have a little more leisure to be with people we love and to do the things that we love.
You make the distinction, Mary Pfeiffer, between young old and old old. What's the difference?
Well, that's a distinction made by a psychologist, Bernice Newgarden, some time ago. And when I wrote my book, Another Country, I used that distinction. The distinction is when you lose your health or you lose some aspect of your being so that you can no longer function the way you want to function as a vital person, you've entered old age. However, my own experience now that I'm in that life stage myself is quite different, which is almost all of the women I know that are my age or older have lost some functioning, but we've also become experts at adapting and working around. So we aren't really in old age, we're in young old age with adaptations. Mm.
Explain the title of your book, Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. Why the word rowing? Why not sailing or floating or something like that?
Oh, thank you, Jane, for asking me that question. What I wanted to convey by the word rowing is the fact that if we're going to be happy in this life stage, it's going to take work. It's going to take a real sense of focus and concentration. It's going to involve waking up in the morning and making conscious choices about what we're going to pay attention to that day and setting our intention for the day. It's going to take reminding ourselves to be grateful and to view the world with loving eyes. I'm a very big believer that we don't see the world the way it is. We see it the way we are. And that if we go about the world looking for love and humor and joy, that's what we'll find. But if we wake up in the morning and our bones are hurting us a little bit, or we are aware when we first wake up our best friend has cancer, then it takes a certain amount of effort to set our intention and focus and build for ourselves a good day.
To that point, you write, if we have planned carefully and packed properly, if we have good maps and guides, the journey can be transcendent. Mm-hmm. It made me wonder, it's such a beautiful quote, but it made me wonder, well, what if you haven't? What if you've lived in poverty or abuse? And there have been a lot of reasons why the journey is not transcendent as you get older, and it's really not your fault. You know, what do you say to that?
Well, you know, it's very interesting, but my experience writing this book, I interviewed many women who'd gone through all kinds of severe life crises. In fact, one woman your listeners are probably aware of is Mary Oliver. And she's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. She came from a very abusive family, had a very difficult life. And yet, by the time she was an older woman and writing her beautiful poetry, there's no question but what she had created a transcendent response for herself. Another thing I found, Jane, and this is an interesting thing about America right now, we're so polarized. We're so putting people into categories based on income and race and so on, education and so on, that we forget a very basic fact about human nature, which is all of us, rich or poor, experience the entire gamut of human emotions. And we all not only have a right to do that, but that is what makes us human and gives us a common human bond and connection to each other. So, for example, one of the things I found in this book was the happiest women I met were not upper middle class women who had easy lives. On the contrary, they were women who'd had very difficult lives and had worked hard to figure out how to be happy in spite of being disabled or broke or having great deal of trouble taking care of, for example, a brain-damaged daughter who never learned to walk or speak. So it's just a very interesting thing to me that a kind of a common American assumption is, for example, that poor people are unhappy and rich people are happy. Mm-hmm. It's not true at all. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that I don't think we should have a much more level playing field. I think there's systemic problems with health care, with our financial system. Certainly, there's systemic problems in the ways we isolate older people from younger people. It's not that I'm saying the culture doesn't need to improve a great deal in its treatment of older people. It's just that I'm saying, as a psychologist, my interest is in cultivating resilient responses.
So in looking at age and how we age, what have you learned about yourself from the process of writing this book?
Well, it's very interesting. I always write what I need to understand, and I always teach what I need to learn. And so one of the things that was very important to me writing this book was to figure out how to be a happy older person myself. I'm not a naturally sunny person, and the joy and happiness I've found is hard won. Furthermore, my experience of life at this stage is that almost daily, the joys and sorrows of life are as mixed together as sea salt and water. And so the question then is, how do we have a good day on a day we're visiting hospice to see one of our friends? How do we have a good day as we face our own mortality? And I've written about this. I've talked to women I respect and admired about this. And the book has actually helped me have a pretty good sense for the ideal ways to proceed. Not that I proceed that way all the time. None of us do. But I have a sense for the ideal ways to proceed.
We are embracing a radical rethink of aging this hour for women. Mary Pfeiffer is my guest. Her new book is Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. You can join the conversation. How do you view life now? Do the losses leave you flattened? Or are you rebounding in a way you couldn't in your youth? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing life and loss in the time of aging this hour, and you can join the conversation. Are you happier now, not sweating the small stuff so much, or is it really getting harder as you get older, especially as a woman? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today, Mary Pfeiffer, psychologist and author of the new book, Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. I want to play this clip from Nobel Prize-winning writer Toni Morrison. She gave the commencement address at Wellesley College in 2004. She said that the graduates had her condolences if their time in college had been the best years of their lives. She spoke about the joys of adulthood, about getting older and growing up throughout your life.
There is nothing, believe me, more satisfying, more gratifying than true adulthood. The adulthood that is the span of life before you. The process of becoming one is not inevitable. Its achievement is a difficult beauty, an intensely hard won glory.
I love that, Mary Pfeiffer. A difficult beauty, an intensely hard won glory to get on.
Oh, she's a wonderful writer. That
Isn't
was
she?
Beautiful.
Yeah. So her speaking to young women at Wellesley College reminded me of your wildly popular book in 1994, Reviving Ophelia, where you talked about the cultural perceptions of adolescent girls and how they didn't match your experience working with young girls. Tell me, kind of bookend these books. I mean, what do adolescent teen girls and women entering old age have in common?
Well, they're both entering a portal, and they're both at a point where they're poised for growth and change, and they're getting very little cultural education on how to do that properly. So one of the reasons I wrote Reviving Ophelia is I was working as a therapist. I was seeing almost full-time teenage girls in my office, and I was continually struck by how different the situation was than the cultural stories about teenage girls and their families. When I wrote that book, the cultural story about a teenage girl who was feeling depressed or anxious or angry or misbehaving was that she was from a dysfunctional family. And on the contrary, what I was observing is the kind of parents who bring their daughters to a private practice therapist and are very concerned about them tend to be pretty healthy families. And what was happening to girls was they were dealing with a toxic culture and getting absolutely no good information, nor were the adults around them, on how to be healthy, resilient people in this life stage. So this book is very similar. I hope it's what I would really like to see happen with this book, Jane, is that it starts a whole new cultural conversation about the concept of aging and the potentials for growth in this life stage. You know, if we don't believe in our potential to grow, we're unlikely to grow. And if we believe in the truth of the cultural scripts about us, we're likely to live out those scripts. So for me, it's a terrible tragedy if women, if all of us, aren't given opportunities to grow and develop into all we can be.
The board is full of calls here, Mary. Let me take a couple here at the top. Ellen in Clearwater, Florida, you're first. Welcome to the program with Mary Pfeiffer.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment about your guest's earlier mentioning about losing friends and relatives once they get to be in our 70s. I have, since 1982, been a sailboat racer, and I belong to this very active sailboat racing club. And we really, really encourage young people, teenagers and young adults, to join the club. And the interaction among the generations is just absolutely amazing because they're interested in learning how to sail, and we've got many, many years of experience. So it's wonderful. And the other thing that I embarked on in my mid-60s was playwriting. So I started doing that. I started directing and producing, and that's opened up a whole new world for me, plus a lot of new friends and a whole different mindset from sailboat racing. So I think there's hope for those of us who are losing our friends to death in our 70s because there's another generation coming up behind us because we've been saying for years, make younger friends.
That's interesting. Ellen, thank you. Mary Pfeiffer, it brings up a really important point about this intergenerational interaction between the older and the younger. What do you say about that?
Well, I think it's great. I think it's very sad in America how people are segregated by age. And there's four-year-olds all over the country who could really use an older woman or older man rocking them and telling them stories and playing with them. And there's lonely adults all over the country, older adults who would love to spend time with children, 20-year-olds, 40-year-olds. I've been very lucky because I'm an activist and I'm involved in a lot of civic action in my own community. And one of the more active age groups for that is people in their 20s and 30s. So I've been able to stay in good touch with younger people. And one of the things, by the way, about staying in good touch with younger people is staying green on top, as my Aunt Margaret would say, which means being a lifelong learner and being willing to, for example, start writing plays in your 60s,
right,
and challenge other people around you to join you in a group of playwriting. So I think your last listener was very green on top.
Love that, green on top. Ellen, thank you for the call. Here's Kathy in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Jane.
Hi.
Well, first, I'm so delighted to hear Mary Pfeiffer speak because I think she's a phenomenal writer, but I've never heard her talk before. And I'm a life coach for women primarily in their 50s and above regarding health and wellness. And one of the nice things about that area is speaking with people about just having their own authenticity, and I find that Mary sounds so authentic and real. So, but the other qualities that I think are so important are taking the time to avoid fear, say, in the political climate by perhaps meditating, which is so wonderful to reduce stress, and having excellent sleep, like 7 to 9 hours mm-hmm. of good sleep. You feel wake up and you feel great. Mm-hmm. Easy and exercise and yoga are just so important because the muscles have to... They're not like machines. They grow stronger as
with
we
use.
Them.
Yeah, and a lot of good self-care is what I hear you saying, Kathy. Thank you. And her first point, Mary Pfeiffer, was very important, this notion of authenticity. And you say in your book that a gift in this life stage is authenticity. You've got nothing to prove. You're finally comfortable in your own skin. It's a really important point, no?
Absolutely. And we stop being afraid and move into an ability to be honest with ourselves. We start giving ourselves permission to not be in any room we don't want to be in. We grant ourselves the power of saying no. We grant ourselves the power of listening to that voice inside us that tells us what we would need and like and saying yes to that voice. So there's an authenticity that comes with this life stage. I think there's a great growth in moral imagination. We tend to be more empathic and kind. I also think that the other great gifts of this life stage are an enhanced capacity for bliss. And that bliss comes in part from our awareness of our own mortality. The mm-hmm. runway is short, and we have good research to show that the shorter you perceive your lifetime to be ahead of you, the more likely you are to be deeply grateful and joyous for that which is happening around you.
Mm. Talk more about that enhanced capacity for bliss. That's great.
Yeah. Well, you know, by the time we're 70 or 71, we've had a lot of years figuring out how to manage our expectations, how to create good days for ourselves. And we start having some more time. And that time may be the first discretionary time we've had since we were children. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I really like, for example, about being 71 is I pretty much spend my time doing exactly what I liked to do when I was 10 years old. When I was 10 years old, I liked to swim. I liked to read books. I like to be with my friends and my family, and I like to be outdoors. And I have more time for that. And I think one way that bliss comes to people is they actually are not in a hurry. It's very hard to feel bliss if you're not moving slowly and if you're not awake and savoring the experiences around you. So, for example, one of the things I say in the book is, it's possible to walk out of a friend's funeral and still feel a moment of bliss when you hear the wild geese overhead and taste a snowflake on your tongue. We start having this ability to find within any moment some possibility of joy and bliss. And it's a wonderful gift that, at least for me and for many of my friends, is coming at a relatively late time in our lives.
So great. Madeline is on the line from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Madeline. You're on.
Hi there, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
I am so, now I have to get this book because it's so in line. I love the name of the program, On Point. She's so on point, Marius. I am 71 in a couple of weeks. And when I was 62, I guess, I developed lymphoma. And then after that, I developed Crohn's, and then I have lupus. And the way one looks at one's challenges does make a huge difference, because any one of those could knock one right off the map. Mm. And I didn't. I didn't fall off the map, because that the analogy of rowing is just, I'm a biker, and the first year that I was diagnosed with the lymphoma, I did the Harbor of the Bay ride. My friends encouraged me to only do half of it because, you know, chemo. Mm-hmm, they were right. It was wonderful. Being outside on my bike, Yes, I liked doing that when I was 8 years old.
Mm-hmm. Well, Madeline, thank you so much. It's a great call, and it brings up another point. You know, Mary, the way you look at challenges defines you. You talk about this a lot in the book. You know, some women are disabled by a hangnail. Others can be hit by a truck. Keep smiling. I mean, there's Madeline there with lymphoma and other, you know, serious health challenges,
absolutely.
And she plows forward.
Well, one of the things I say in the book is we don't have control of a great deal that happens to us, especially as we age, but we have choices. And the fact that we have choices gives us a certain kind of power. And Madeline's a really good example of someone who's made excellent choices. Another way I say this in the book is all our lives, we keep appointments we did not make. And those things just happen to us. And we have a lot of choice, not only about how we respond to those appointments, but we also have choices about the stories we tell ourselves about what happens to us. And those stories can be problem-saturated stories that make us feel sorry for ourselves and feel hopeless and miserable. Or they can be empowering stories. They can be stories that I have a chapter in the book, Women Roy North, called Crafting Resplendent Narratives. They can be stories that give us a sense of hope and meaning and a sort of a sense that what we're doing and how we do it is important and will make us deeper and better people.
All our lives, we keep appointments we did not make. That's really good. Patty is on the line from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Patty. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for this wonderful program.
Thank you.
I just wanted to share that I find, at least for me, that as I age, I spend more time feeling more powerful, more certain of my strengths, and more certain of who I am. And I spend more time occupying that space. But in the moments when I don't, in the moments when that fear creeps in, it seems to be in a much deeper space than I've ever felt before, because it comes from a knowledge that our society doesn't value older women, and nor is it set up to have good support systems. And I'm just looking forward to spending my remaining time nurturing and guiding the young women coming up after me.
Mm. Patty, thank you very much. Mary Pfeiffer.
Yeah, well, one of the things that happens, I think, in our 70s is we realize that the validation we get is going to come from primarily three sources. One is the people who love us, our life partners, our close women friends. I call women friends my emotional health insurance policy, mental health insurance policy. Because while a lot of older women, including me, spend a lot of time taking care of other people, my women friends take care of me. But finally, the person who really ends up validating us the most is ourselves. And we learn the skills to make ourselves happy, to feel ourselves useful. And actually, let me put it very simply. We learn to love that crazy lost baby in ourselves and to take good care of her and to be grateful for the fact that the sun comes up every morning.
And you're right. We become deeper and kinder to ourselves. I think that's an important point as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, partly as we accept ourselves, we have more love, kindness, and acceptance of other people. As we realize how flawed we are, and what a mercy it is that the people around us love us, not only in spite of our flaws, but partly because of them, then we can eventually be at the point where what we're sending the world as a message is, I love you. I love you even though I know that you're as flawed, mixed up, filled with contradictions, and amazing as I am. And so our moral imagination, hopefully by the time we die, increases to the point that we can include all living beings in our circle of caring.
What would you tell women who are listening right now who are thinking, this is not my story, this is not me, I am unhappy in my older age and things are hard? What would you say to them?
Well, first of all, I'd be deeply sympathetic with them because, of course, I have no idea who's listening to your show, and I'm sure there's some people listening that have very difficult situations in their lives right now, and I have nothing but sympathy for them. On the other hand, I think everyone who's listening to this program can be happier, and that there's ways to be happier, and I would hope that something I said today is useful to them.
We are talking about taking charge of your life, no matter how many birthday candles are on the cake. You can join the conversation. Are you a role model to the younger women in your life? Do you want to see more people who look like you on TV, in the media, and more people like you in the movies who are happy and at peace? Much more with Mary Pfeiffer after the break. Her book is Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about getting wiser and happier as we get older. You can join the conversation, listeners. Have you been more of your true self as you've aged? Is there a renewed authenticity in your life? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. My guest today, Mary Pfeiffer, psychologist and author of many New York Times bestselling books. Her latest is Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. Here is a 1971 commercial for Clairol's Loving Care hair dye, which said on the bottle that it would wash that gray right out of your hair.
You look like no 18-year-old could, 'cause you're a woman, and I see you're not getting old.
Hair color that gives you not just better color, better hair. You're not getting older. You're getting better.
No doubt about it. And here's the pilot episode of The Golden Girls, where Rose, played by Betty White, laments to Dorothy and Sophia about loneliness and what might happen if Blanche marries a potential suitor and they have to move.
It's not fair, you know. I mean, we get married, we have kids. The kids leave and our husbands die. Is that some kind of a test? You don't work that hard. You don't go through everything you go through to be left alone. We are alone, Dorothy. We really are. Our families are gone and we're alone. And there are too many years left and I don't know what to do.
Get a poodle.
Mary Pfeiffer, talk about loneliness in older age.
Well, you really have good clips on this show, Jane. Those were really good clips.
We have a
first of all,
awesome
the
step.
Advice, get a poodle wasn't bad because there's a difference between loneliness and solitude. And without question, we know the research on this. As people get older, they spend more time alone. They aren't in the workforce often, 8 hours a day. They aren't raising young children. Some of their friends move away or die. They have they just have more time when they're at home or in their apartment alone. On the other hand, I think one of the secrets of staying green on top and resilient in this life stage is making sure you're deeply engaged and connected to the world and that you wake up every day with a sense of purpose. I think a sense of purpose is about as necessary to life as oxygen. So there's nobody out there that can't find some way to be important to somebody and to be useful. One of the tricks I have when I'm feeling gloomy and just lonesome and out of sorts is I'll think to myself, is there anybody in the world that if I called him up, it'd cheer him up and make him feel better? And I can almost always think of somebody who'd enjoy a phone call from me. So I think it's very important to stay connected and have contact with other human beings as much as possible. On the other hand, I have to say that solitude is a beautiful state. And many of my women friends are saying how much they enjoy their solitude. And they're reading, they're meditating, they're gardening, they're doing all kinds of things. Many of them are becoming creative people who are painting or taking up various forms of self-expression. So loneliness and solitude are two different things. And that's another area where I think we have a lot of choices in terms of how we want to view it and what we want to make of more time by ourselves.
Got to get more calls in here. Brenda is in Culpeper, Virginia. Hi, Brenda. You're on the air.
Thank you. I think the book reinforces a lot of things that have been said to women aging over the years, and they are good because a lot of women haven't heard those things. But the biggest thing that I think affects women is our economics as they age and the new reality of economics in this day and time, where a lot of women are depressed, and especially when they first reach that age of 70 or 65, and they really don't have the finances to reach out and do different things like you have been talking about, which are all good if you are not so depressed and so broke that you can't do them. Mm-hmm.
Brenda, but thank you. I'm going to jump in because I want Mary to respond to the economics of older age. Brenda, thank you so much for the call.
Well, first of all, Brenda, I agree with you totally that there's many women who are very much suffering financially, and that it has an impact on the possibilities for them in terms of what they do. On the other hand, I have to say that I interviewed some very poor women for this book and in very poor health, and many of them were managing to have quite a good time. And at least from my experience, almost all the things I take pleasure in at 70 don't cost money. They're things that have to do with relationship. They have to do with enjoying the natural world, enjoying company with myself. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that everyone doesn't need good medical care, access to good, healthy food, a living environment that's safe and pleasant. The only reason I don't mention those things on this show is I have no idea about how to create those things for all the older women in America. I wish I could. But what I understand, and this is from my years of being a therapist and my 3 years of thinking through this book, is how to live with whatever circumstances we are given, which is, I think, the secret of happiness. I visited an older woman, Jane Jarvis. She was a jazz great. But I visited her in her 90s. She was living in a tiny little apartment. She couldn't get out of bed by herself. Very, very poor. She had a caregiver come in once a day to help her clean her up and help her with some food and all. So I went to see her. And after I visited with her for a while, I said, "Now, Jane, are you all right? Do you have everything you need?" And she looked at me and she said, "Mary, I have everything I need to be happy right between my ears." And she pointed at her brain. And that's really my argument, Brenda, that all of us, whether we're rich or poor, need to depend on what we have right between our ears if we're going to wake up and be happy in this life stage.
Brenda, thank you. Here's Joanne from Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Joanne. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. I want to say this is brilliant, and I can't wait to read the book. I'd like to ask your guest what to do. I've just turned 60, retired school teacher, and I think I've come to this awareness, oh, my gosh, I'm old. And I have to grieve some things that will never occur in my life. I've never been married. I never had children. I think the prospect of learning foreign language really well or playing a musical instrument, you know, it's harder to do when you're older. And my issue that's really blocking me from the creativity and joy is the grief of things that never will occur. And I'd like to hear some pointers on how to manage that.
Great question, Joanne. Thank you. Mary?
Well, first of all, I don't argue that we shouldn't feel grief. I think grief is one of the primary emotions of this life stage. And I encourage you to respect your grief, to honor it, and to learn from it. On the other hand, I would be careful to not say never. Never say never is a very good motto. And in your case, for example, it sounds like right now when you think of regrets, you feel badly, and you're not sure what your future holds. You sort of see your future in a way as being a diminished version of your former self. And that will not work. If you do not make some choices and decide to grow bigger, you will be bitter and you will be sad. But I heard in what you were saying the potential already for taking a foreign language and learning to play an instrument. And those are things you can still do, and I would highly encourage you to do because I can tell they're on your mind.
Joanne, thank you. Mary Pfeiffer, along those lines, you talk about grief, about transforming grief into something helpful and useful. You wrote about a woman named Pat who lost her husband to cancer, right? She's got a new partner now, but she uses that old grief to transform her life now.
Oh, yeah. You know, many people can tell a story about this or know a story about this. But my friend Pat, I wrote about her husband Jerry's death. And I interviewed her 2 years after Jerry died, which is the story in the book. But it's now been a couple years since that happened. Well, when I interviewed her, she was still in a stage of terribly missing Jerry. I think she'll miss him the rest of her life. I don't think we get over grieving for loved people. I think we get used to it. And we move into lives that allow us to be happy in spite of that asterisk that the person we loved is no longer present in the world with us. But what Pat did, Jerry died very rapidly of esophageal cancer. And what she's still doing is helping people all around the country who get that diagnosis. And I think that's what I would call a transcendent response to grief, which is to figure out a way to take one's sorrow and despair and turn it into something helpful for other people.
Here's Christina in Newport News, Virginia. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Jane. So I'm actually a younger listener. This all just reminded me of my grandmother, actually. She was a mother of five, a teacher, busy all of her life, as well as taking care of her husband. And I found some ageism just on, you know, my own end when she lost her firstborn son. He had Down. She was taking care of him his entire life. And then she lost him, and a few years later lost my grandfather. And all of us assumed, oh, she's going to need a caretaker. This is it. This, you know, we're going to lose her in a couple years. And that didn't happen. And now that I talk with her, you know, she really enjoys the solitude. We go and visit her every once in a while, but this is the first time she's really been able to go, hey, this is me. And I found that beautiful. And now I don't just see her as a grandmother. You know, I see her sort of as a mentor, too.
And how old is she now, Christina?
She's about to turn 90, actually. Wow. So
that's a great call. Thank you so much. No, I appreciate it. Good luck to that sweet grandma. Mary Pfeiffer, would you like to say anything here?
Well, I hope everybody listening is lucky enough to have had a sweet grandmother. You know, one of the things that's a great comfort as I get older is what I call the shelter belt of my family, which goes back, I remember my great grandmother, Granny Lee, an Ozark grandma. And my two grandmothers were wonderful to me. When I can't sleep at night, one of the things I do is I remember my grandma Margaret Agnes Kitchen. And she had a special relationship with me. When our family'd be out there, she'd ask me to help her do the dishes. And we'd go in the kitchen, and she called me My Mary. And she said, now let's do these dishes real slow so we can talk. And one time we showed up there and I said, Grandma, what are we having for dinner? And she said, pork chops. And I said, oh, I love those pork chops. And she said, I know you do. That's why we're having them. And that was the first time I ever had the realization, oh, somebody would go to a lot of work just for me to make me happy. But anyway, when I can't sleep at night, One way I can go to sleep is I can open the doors of the cabinets in my grandma's kitchen in my mind. And I can remember the water glasses and the coffee cups and plates and saucers and her sink with her little bottle of detergent and then the next cabinet over. And about the time I get to that cookie jar of molasses cookies, I fall asleep. It's wonderful to have a grandmother in your life, and if your grandmother's long gone, it's wonderful to have these memories to keep you warm at night.
IC is in Richmond, Virginia. Hi, IC, you're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to say, as a man, that this was a wonderful discussion, and I just wanted to lend my voice to that process of just saying that. My wife and I have been together 43 years, and I'll just say that I'm 69. So, but part of what my values have been is to make her feel as exciting and as valuable to herself and the community and to our family. And she is. And I think that this is a message that men need to hear and women need to hear about men. And the example that I gave, if I may share, when I was teaching, I used to tell young women in my class, because there were a lot of young women in class, and most of them were young African-American women, was this, that my wife and I had been together X amount of years, and they'd say, oh, and I'd say, yes, but we didn't get married and stay together because we loved each other. I said, and they said, what? And I said, we stay together because we can do business together. And business is a more detailed transaction sometime, or added transaction to just loving somebody. People love each other on divorce court every day. But to stay together and to do business and to trust and to be able to do finances and to boost and to make sure that if I have a doctorate, that my wife has a doctorate, those are the kind of things that I think are important for men to do. So I'm going to read the book and enjoy the discussion.
I see. Thank you very much for the call there from Richmond. They had purpose together, Mary, really.
Right. Well, I see sounds like a wonderful husband, and I'm happy to hear that he enjoyed this conversation. One of the things that surprised me, Jane, is a lot of men have written me to say that they really like this book, and I hadn't anticipated that at all, but I'm delighted by that. The other thing I want to say in response to IC's call is there's a chapter in this book on long-term marriages. And there is something to me so beautiful about these relationships where a couple has stayed together across decades. And a lot of times, through very hard times in the relationship, there's been ups and downs. But by time a couple's been together so many years, they have this beautiful shared memory bank and a kind of sweetness and kindness toward each other that is just really beautiful to behold.
I've got 15 seconds left. What would you like us to know?
Well, I guess I would like to say a Native American blessing that has to do with gratitude, which is the most important lesson in the book. And here is my blessing to your audience. Give thanks for unknown blessings that are already on their way to you.
Mary Pfeiffer, psychologist and author of Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. A beautiful conversation. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Jane. I enjoyed it.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.